It is a physical therapy day on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. Our physical therapists are back. Jill Tine Nissenbaum and Lori Tine Brody. Jill, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to see you.
It's great to be here.
And Lori Tine Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Lori, good to see you.
Awesome to be here on a beautiful October day.
We will start by talking about the importance of strengthening your knee and hip muscles after, maybe before, too, total hip replacement surgery. And certainly invite your questions as we move along today. Maybe you or someone you know has had a hip or knee replaced. Tell us about it. Maybe you want some advice on how to avoid hip pain and surgery. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. First, let's talk about hip arthroplasty, also known, I guess, as hip replacement.
Right.
When is a hip replacement necessary, Jill?
Well, that's a great question. And I love Lori's answer to that when it is typically when your bad days start to outweigh your good days and you feel like it's compromising your lifestyle, it's probably time. So you will need to report pain. We can't go simply on radiographic changes because we know people have significant radiographic changes or changes on x-ray and don't have that much pain. So we need to do a good clinical exam and identify deficits, weakness, decreased mobility, pain with walking, pain and stiffness in the morning, perhaps, and then those things start really impeding your lifestyle where you're not going to do those activities you normally would do because your pain, weakness, and or pain or hip pain or weakness is limiting you from doing those things.
Right. When, you know, I don't go out in my garden anymore because I can't get back up if I get down because I have pain. So one of the things that I tell people to watch for is that their world is getting smaller. That is, they're doing fewer things, the things that they used to do. They become more sedentary. They spend more time at home. They spend more time sitting. They sit to prepare their food and so on. And so those are the subtle things that we look for that say it's time to intervene before this affects other aspects of your life, your general health, your body mass index, your strength, your cardiovascular function, because you're being less active.
And your mental health. Socialization
yes.
is a big
yes.
deal. So I'm not going to go to the farmer's market anymore because I can't walk all the way from my car to the market and walk around
all
the market.
All the way around.
Right.
Yeah.
So those are the kind of things that Lori's referring to.
So we go ahead and have it. How long does it take to recover from hip replacement?
Well, recovery is a million-dollar question, which kind of brings us a little bit into this paper. So
right,
I would definitely say that people who have a total hip replacement will report that their pain has subsided very, very quickly. In other words, once the postoperative pain is over, most people feel much, much better with regards to their hip replacement. A knee replacement's a little bit different in that you have to really work on range of motion. That's not so much the case with a hip replacement. So postoperatively, people feel pretty good after their postoperative pain is gone, but
right, but there's residual weakness.
Right.
And one of the, so when people get a knee replacement, which is a really difficult surgery to recover from, a total hip replacement is very different from that in that people usually feel a lot less pain and they feel better after their surgery. And as a result of that, often we see surgeons who will not refer their patients to physical therapy afterwards because the patient reports that their pain is better. However, what we've seen from
this...
You
got a study for us here.
We have a study for you, found that up to 12 months following a total hip replacement, that the patients showed deficits in their hip strength on the surgical side and on the non-surgical side, as well as deficits in strength in the muscles around the knee. So many times in the literature on hip replacement, they compare the surgical side to the non-surgical side, and they say, oh, the surgical side is the same as the non-surgical side, so they're fully recovered. This paper was one of the first ones to compare the surgical side and the non-surgical side at the hip and at the knee to control groups of the same age and general health. And they found that these people had strength deficits 12 months following their hip replacement on both sides and in their knee. Not only that, these people, this study was done in Japan, so of course there's limitations. One of the other interesting limitations, and this is what I say to my students, how many of you have read the method section of the paper? They all look down.
Because they just read the results.
Because they only read the abstract and the results. These patients were in the hospital for 3 weeks following their hip. Right, right. Who's in the hospital for 3 weeks? Here it's an outpatient procedure.
And then they had outpatient rehabilitation for 5 months. So compared to how we manage patients, status post total hip arthroplasty in the United States, these people had what I would call the Cadillac of care.
Yes and no. So I'm going to push back on that a little bit. Yes, they had a lot of therapy, but they were in the hospital for 3 weeks. Like, what do you do in the hospital?
Right, right.
You lay around a lot. If you're at home and you have to manage for yourself, you have to cook, you have to clean, you have to shop, you have to do all those things, you want to get back out in your garden. I'm not sure what happened in those first 3 weeks. If it was better to be in the hospital getting therapy, you know.
Are the procedures different?
No,
Japan?
No. Mm-mm.
The surgical procedures, no.
Yeah, no, they were all posterolateral or lateral procedures.
Right.
So, yeah, no, there's no difference in the procedure. It's just interesting, the healthcare system. And I can't say whether that 3 weeks in the hospital was helpful or inhibited the return of their strength.
And similarly, we do it as an outpatient procedure, and the same thing could be true here in the United States. There could be some people who are like, yep, I'm going to get back up, and I'm going to do my gardening, and I'm going to go out and about, and I'm going to be social. And there may be other people who have a little bit of a fear avoidance who actually are a little less mobile and more sedentary. So it
wouldn't be bad to replicate this study in the U.S.
It would be amazing.
Well,
do you have that kind of money, Larry?
No, I think the gauntlet has been dropped here.
Right, I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea. And one of the things I found very interesting, because there is a little bit of debate about the surgical approach, because with a posterolateral approach, you have to cut through the gluteus medius and then reattach it. And that's the big kind of hip stabilizing muscle. And in this study, what they found is that the opposite side was also incredibly weak. So we can't say the incision in and of itself is causative for that hip weakness.
Right, right, exactly. There are a lot of variables. Right.
So here you two are physical therapist experts. What exercises, let's put it that way, should people do during their recovery from hip replacement surgery to increase? Because you don't want to lose.
Absolutely.
Oh, right, right, right. So the first thing is these patients need to come to therapy after their hip replacement, even if their pain is much better. Because what we see is down the road, that hip weakness will catch up with them.
Mm-hmm.
They'll come back with trochanteric bursitis. They'll come back with back pain. They'll come back with knee pain because the muscles around their hips are not doing what they're supposed to do. So come in and get set up on an exercise program to strengthen these hip abductor muscles, the ones that stabilize the hip, that raise your leg out to the side, that externally rotate your hip.
And it's also very important to work on balance. Mm-hmm. So this demographic is typically a demographic that's also at risk for falls. So not only do they need to work on strength, but they need to work on balance as well. And I think the other thing we've learned with this population is, I think as physical therapists, many times we're hesitant to really add load. And there's been a lot of compelling research that shows that people can perform heavy resistance strength training in an appropriate environment. So I think we're always afraid we're just going to put a little 1-pound weight on that person because they're elderly, whatever. As long as they have good bone strength and coordination and they're in a stable environment, we shouldn't be hesitant to load this muscle group.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, let's think about walking for a minute. What, mm-hmm. after, how soon do people get up after a hip replacement surgery here in this country?
Immediately. Yep. Immediately. We get them up right away, and if they can, excuse me, poop and pee.
They go home.
They go home. Yep.
They go home the same day.
They go home the same day.
So you have to be safe with your assistive device. Mm-hmm. Most people leave with a walker of some sort mm-hmm. or a wheeled walker, but as long as their GI system is functioning and they're safe, they go home.
Right. Yeah. And if they have stairs in their home, the physical therapist will make sure they can ascend and descend stairs so mm-hmm. they can get safely in and out of their home. Yeah. But those are a very low bar for getting out.
Right. And the other thing is for most people in the United States, this is an elective procedure, mm-hmm. so they plan ahead. So they plan ahead to have someone in the house to help them. They may plan ahead to rent a hospital bed on the mm-hmm. first floor, or they get a commode, things mm-hmm. like that, so they don't have to go up and down the stairs right away. So, they can plan ahead for that, which is also very helpful.
Right.
Before we go to the phones and Dan and Muscadet, I wanted one more question about this. How do we avoid, what preventive measures, let's put it that way, should we take to avoid needing a total hip replacement?
Well, there's many things. First of all, it's maintaining an active lifestyle, maintaining your body mass index at a healthy weight, continuing to perform some sort of resistance training, doing some sort of balance type activities, whether it's Tai Chi or something like that. And then a variety of cardiovascular activity, I think, is kind of key.
Yeah. And some of it is genetic. It's how mm-hmm. well you picked your parents. And sometimes it's inevitable. Or perhaps you've had an accident of some sort. Or mm-hmm. You have congenital hip dysplasia where the sockets are more shallow and you end up there. There are things that are out of our control. But the things that we control, you know, like most things in life related to total body inflammation and joint disease, is exercise and nutrition.
Yep.
Yeah. Makes sense. Dan and Muscadet will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dan.
Hi there, Larry and Jess. The reason I'm calling is I tore my hamstring back in June, beginning of June. I hobbled around for a couple of weeks, went to the doctor. They told me, yes, I did that. But every once in a while now, I can be walking, and it's like my leg will give out a little bit in that back area. Is it something I should be concerned about, or are there exercises that I can do to help strengthen that?
Feel like your knee buckling, or
not my knees so much. It feels like my leg gets like it pulls itself forward in a sense. Hmm.
Did you have a complete tear, and was it at your buttock area or at your knee area?
At the buttocks area, and terribly black and blue.
Okay. Yeah, so that's what we call a proximal hamstring avulsion, where you pull off that attachment right at that bone that you sit on your sit bone. Can I ask how you did it?
Getting out of a swimming pool, and immediately I tucked and rolled. They thought it hit my head, but no, it's just my hamstring. Both one leg went forward, the other one went back.
Oh, so you slipped?
Pardon me?
You slipped?
Yeah, I slipped.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Because usually just getting out of a swimming pool wouldn't result in that traumatic an injury.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, so it's that eccentric contraction where that's forceful that mm-hmm. pulls off. So did you avulse the bone? Do you know? Or was it a mixed substance?
I went after about 2 weeks because I just hobbled around for the whole week. It was the first day of vacation. I don't know for sure. I don't know if they did any x-rays. I think they just kind of felt it and looked around where the bruising was.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But after 3 or 4 weeks, it kind of went away. But now I notice that my leg kind of just goes forward a little bit.
Right. So you've lost one of your kind of key stabilizers on your posterior chain. And what happens a lot of times is that kind of rolls down like a lampshade and you can mm-hmm. get kind of a glob mm-hmm. of knot and scar tissue in that muscle. And you want that muscle to kind of, the fibers to kind of re-along the length of the hamstring. So if you haven't seen a physical therapist, it's still not too late.
No.
I definitely think that would be a good thing to see, to kind of get that tissue to remodel a little bit, strengthen the complementary muscles to make sure this doesn't happen, the right. buckling doesn't happen, because you don't want to fall.
Right. And you may unknowingly be compensating for that tear. You may have subtly changed your gait, et cetera. And so you need them to examine your gait, make sure you're walking normally, and make sure you're firing your hamstrings appropriately during the gait cycle. So there may be some avoidance there that you're not cognitively aware of. So checking in with somebody who can evaluate your gait, evaluate your hamstring flexibility and strength, and set you up on a program to keep you strong and healthy is going to be key.
There you go, Dan. Thank you so much for calling. Taking a look at physical therapy issues on the show today with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking physical therapy issues today on the show with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori is physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. So great to have them with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Dawn emailed, this goes back to the hip pain. Where is hip pain in a so-called bad hip most likely to occur? Would it be on the outside of the hip, or more in the groin area? It sounds like Dawn may be trying to
figure so that out. That's a great question. So typically hip pain refers to the groin. So people will complain of pain kind of deep in their joint. A lot of people will do what we call a C sign, and they'll take their hand like a C clamp, and they'll pinch the front and back of their hip, and they'll say, it's deep in my hip. If these, if my finger and thumb could come together deep, that's where I feel my pain, and that it refers to the groin. Pain on the lateral side of the hip could be greater trochanteric bursitis as a compensation due to a Trendelenburg gait or a limp, or that could be coming from your back.
Yeah, there's a lot of places, but in my experience, primary hip osteoarthritis presents as groin pain.
Yep.
All right. Herb in Boston has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Herb.
Good afternoon. I had a knee replacement about 8 weeks ago, and I had to have another one done on my left knee. And I found a surgeon that uses ablation therapy before the operation to cut down on the pain after the seizure is done. Wonder if you guys have any opinion on that ablation.
Maybe we should talk about what it is.
Is that the genicular nerve?
I know it's to go in and kill the nerves so that you don't experience that pain.
Yeah. Right. So an ablations are done typically in the musculoskeletal world for nerves. I see a lot of people with chronic knee pain who have the genicular nerve ablated to relieve chronic pain. And
does
so
that mean cut off?
Yes.
Basically they
sever it.
Yeah.
And kind of tie it off. But the genicular nerve doesn't, it's not going to result in weakness.
No, it's just sensory. Just sensory. So thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah.
Yes, we're not
femoral nerve.
Yeah, no, we're not going to result in any weakness. It's just a sensory nerve. So I haven't had any patients who have had it done prior to a knee replacement. That would be that'd be interesting to see. I've just seen people who have chronic knee pain who have had that done as a way to decrease their pain and open up the avenues for physical therapy to be more effective, because sometimes it's the pain that's holding them back. A lot of people don't want to take a lot of narcotics. So, yeah, Herb, didn't have that done the first time, Herb?
No, it's a different surgeon in a different city.
Oh.
And is it okay if I say the name of the city where the other surgeon is that performs it?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's out of Viroqua.
Okay.
I do not know his name.
That's okay.
That's where his office is.
So are you considering having it done with this second total knee?
Yes.
So you're considering having the ablation done with your second total knee when in Viroqua?
Correct.
Okay, well, call us back and let us know.
Yeah, let us know how it goes. We're very interested in this.
Yeah, because you'll have had one total knee without it and one total knee with it.
Yeah. Different surgeons, but that's okay. Yeah.
I'd be really curious.
I'm very curious too. Yeah. So that's a great question, Herb. And, we want to know the answer to that. So when is this scheduled for?
I have not scheduled it yet. I'm trying to make up my mind now.
Okay. Okay. So how's the other one going? You're 8 weeks in and you've decided to switch. You've decided to switch surgeons. So I'm wondering, are things not go well the first time?
It's going good.
Okay. All right.
All right. There we go. So, Herb, after you get it done, call back.
Yeah, call back in about 8 weeks post-op.
Right.
Let's see where you're at and see if it made a difference, if you were able to get through rehab earlier or faster, less pain, although it sounds like this rehab's going well.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe this will accelerate it.
Yeah.
So,
all kinds of reasons why you would go from one to another. It might be insurance, could be anything.
Absolutely. Especially this time of year. People could be switching insurances, things like that.
Sue in Stone Lake, we go to you. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I'm 62 years old, and I'm having some pretty severe pain on the inside of my right knee. So I went in, and they x-rayed both knees. My left knee looks great. My right knee, again, the inside is pretty much bone on bone. There's a bone spur. There's some arthritis showing up in there. And so for now, just to get me through a few things we have in our lives, they did some cortisone in there, but they're recommending a partial knee replacement next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what the benefits of partial over full at my age, is it a good thing to try partial? Should I just do a full right away? So I guess I'd like your opinion on that.
So I'm thrilled that they offered you what we call a unicompartmental knee arthroplasty, meaning that they're only going to replace the compartment that has degenerative changes. So the less we have to take out and put in artificial, the better. Most people, when they get osteoarthritis in their knee, the first compartment to go is that medial compartment on the inside of your knee that you talked about, Sue. And the this will be much less OR time. It'll be a quicker recovery for you. The rehab will be faster. And my understanding is, if in 10 or 15 years down the road, these can be converted successfully into a total knee, from what I've read in the literature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the meantime, make sure you're in as good a shape as you can be in. Maintain as much range of motion and strength as you can, so that when you go into the surgery, you're as healthy, you've maintained your body weight, you've maintained your muscle strength, and that will all help with your recovery.
Mm-hmm.
There you go, Sue. Thank you so much for calling. Chris emailed to ask if hip resurfacing is a good alternative to hip replacement for a 35-year-old female.
Yes, absolutely. If you are a candidate for hip resurfacing, I would strongly encourage that versus a total hip replacement. And a hip resurfacing, basically, I like to say they put a little baseball cap on your femoral head. So there's a lot of what we call bone preservation. So they take out minimal, if any, bone. So you keep your good bone stock. They don't replace the whole femoral head, and they don't stick that that big peg all the way down your femoral shaft. You have no hip precautions with it. And again, my understanding is I'm pretty sure these can be converted to a total hip down the road if they need to be. So in this age category, I would 1,000% go with a hip resurfacing.
Right.
If you're a candidate for it, absolutely.
Yeah.
Less is better.
Less is better. Ben in Sparta, what's on your mind?
Hi. I had a question regarding my shoulder and which route I should go down, because I've been hesitant to do much about it, because for the most part I have mostly normal range of motion, but if I have my arm out in any kind of like wing position and it gets pushed back, I just get just immense pain. But I can't point to any like, oh, I hurt it when I did this kind of situation.
So when you say wing position, you mean like chicken wing, like the chicken dance wing position?
Chicken wing, or like hand on the head where it's not like that. If it gets pushed back past like my mid, that side, and it's just that side, that so in that the shoulder itself.
So you're feeling some pain. It's immediate pain when you when your arm gets pushed back.
Yeah, like which I've noticed it mostly. Like I'll be playing with my daughter, and I went to roll on the grass, and it kind of pushed my arm in that motion. Oh boy, that yeah.
Does it feel? Is it painful or does it feel unstable? Like it's sliding around or going to slide out of joint?
Pain.
Okay.
Pain.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen a physical therapist?
Not for this one. On that same arm, I've been having carpal tunnel symptoms. But
Well.
So maybe some relationship here?
It's very much could be.
It's possible. So absolutely. Are you seeing a PT, an OT?
For your carpal tunnel.
For your carpal tunnel?
It was PT, and I haven't seen them in a bit. I went through a regimen, and it felt a little bit better-ish, but then it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my sister, Lori, and I are both looking at each other and just wondering if there's something coming a little bit more centrally mediated, a.k.a. your neck. So the carpal tunnel, the median nerve, is your C6 nerve root, which is a huge nerve root, and it innervates a whole bunch of stuff at your shoulder. Mm-hmm. So the question is there some sort of nerve entrapment, even a little bit more proximal than your wrist, and it's affecting everything.
Or in the shoulder, like a thoracic outlet kind of a thing.
Correct.
So if he's getting pushed back and that, for example, pec minor is really compressing across there. Yeah, so the bottom line is we think you need to go back to PT, and we need somebody to look at both your neck and your shoulder. So part of me thought, well, maybe he's got a little labral tear.
That was my
first
thought.
And when he gets in that position, it's pinching or tweaking that labral tear. You don't have a history of an injury, but it could be degenerative, could be possibly. Is it your dominant arm?
No.
Okay, so less likely, but definitely something that somebody needs to look at and rule out if the carpal tunnel, the shoulder stuff are related, either at the shoulder or at the neck. And Jill wants to say something.
Well, it's interesting that Ben talks about his arm being up like this. Mm-hmm. And historically, we've always thought of those arm elevation tests as being tests to help rule in thoracic outlet. So if you think about all the muscles on the lateral side of your neck that you would be contracting, I'm leaning a little bit more towards thoracic outlet with just the position.
Yeah, although that's also close to a neural tension test too.
And the ulnar nerve is the other classic thoracic outlet syndrome test.
Yeah.
So
the elevated is to go to the PT the way it sounds.
Yeah. She and I we're sorting this out
options.
Here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. In the meantime, Lori and Larry and I are basically doing the chicken dance.
<in our arms. laughs> So I would go back to PT, have them check your shoulder and your neck. Let us know how you do.
Yeah. Thank you, Ben. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Leslie in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. I'm 58 years old. For the last 3 years, I've had some pretty severe knee pain, and I have gone to physical therapy, but nothing has really given me any relief except for cortisone shots, and I only did that one time. And I also had plasma injections, and that unfortunately didn't help at all. So I'm just wondering, the physical therapy that they gave me, the pain is on the outside of my kneecap and also my knees buckle when I walk. And it seems to be worse when I sit around a lot.
Patellofemoral pain.
Right, yeah. But I'm wondering if syndisc would be, or in... because it sounds to me like she's had PRP and a cortisone injection, but we didn't talk about syndisc, and I don't know if that's more for...
I'm wondering if it's not, if it doesn't sound tibiofemoral from what she's saying, it sounds patellofemoral.
Right.
So I don't know about syndisc at the patellofemoral joint. Have they tried a plunger? Did you try a plunger at your kneecap in your PT before?
No. I don't even know what that is.
Did they give you hip strengthening exercises for your knee?
They had me do the clam, and they had me do the bridge, and that sort of thing. And, but they also told me don't do anything that flares it up and causes swelling. And both those flares it up and causes swelling. So I'm really confused as to what the way forward is. Walking. Huh.
So it's swelling? Because primary patellofemoral isn't usually associated with a lot of swelling. Mm-mm. Unless you're getting like a prepatellar bursitis or you have a fat pad thing going on. When they did the cortisone injection, was it into your big knee joint or was it someplace else?
Big knee joint, yeah, both sides.
Huh, both sides. Mm-hmm. And you had some relief from that?
Yes, it was complete relief, but it only lasted, a month or two.
I do that long.
So are they saying that this is arthritis in your knee? What's the diagnosis here? Has anyone given you a diagnosis?
They did not give me a diagnosis, but when I went in for the plasma injection, I said, can you please look at my chart and tell me what I have? And he's like, well, if I had to guess, I would say osteoarthritis.
Okay.
But I don't know.
So if you have osteoarthritis, and if it's not just under your kneecap, mm-hmm. but it's truly in your tibial mm-hmm. femoral joints, considering a Synvisc injection or a hyaluronic acid injection might be the way to go. It doesn't have the negative side effects as of corticosteroid, and it's basically kind of...
Three shots.
It's three shots, yeah. And Larry should be the spokesperson for it because he had surgery scheduled and had it done. And how long ago was that, Larry, that you had that done?
I had the surgery scheduled. Oh, that was several years back.
Right.
Now, yeah. And but then I had the shots. And by a few weeks after the third shot, I called and canceled the surgery, and I haven't been back.
Yeah. And that was 8 or 10 years ago. So,
yeah.
So there is evidence to show that mm-hmm. they're called hyaluronic acid injections. Synvisc is a brand name. Orthovisc is another one. That shows that it is beneficial in the knee, not so much in the hip. So you may want to consider that. And I know we're talking injection, but this may be enough to jumpstart you so you can do good rehab.
Right, so that your rehab helps.
Right.
And the pain with sitting could be primary tibiofemoral OA as well, just patellofemoral.
It could.
Yeah. So if she got a lot of relief from the cortisone injection, it's sounding more like tibiofemoral. But you need more rehab, mm-hmm. then, I mean, the clam and the bridge, those are a good starting point, only.
Yeah.
So
I think she needs some manual therapy, too. Mm-hmm. That would be better to do some distraction of her tibial femoral joint, the plunger like you talked about. So, finding an OCS or an orthopedic clinical specialist, somebody who can really get in there and dig in with their hands might be a good idea.
Yep.
I can tell you the pain went away, and I haven't had any pain ever since.
Yeah. Larry, you should be the spokesperson. I'm mm-hmm. kidding you not.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Leslie, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Jane in Bessemer, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. I had surgery on my right rotator cuff and bicep 4 weeks ago, and although I'm trying to be as careful as I can and follow all directions, I am a single mom and a grandmother to a one-year-old. And sometimes accidentally, my arm may be stretched out more than it should be. My question is, how will I know I've done too much with my arm if I re-injured myself?
Mm-hmm. Is there a confession coming, Jane?
Right, exactly. So first of all,
it's very hard for me to stay still.
100%. So did you have a rotator cuff repair? Did they fix your rotator cuff, or did you have a debridement?
Repair.
Okay, and then with your biceps, did they cut it, or what did they do with your biceps?
He just said it was shredded, and I couldn't see the pictures on my last visit
Hopefully they did like a tenodesis on that. So she's got a rotator cuff repair and she's mm-hmm. 4 weeks out. So mm-hmm. How will I know if I've done too much? So first of all, it typically takes a fair amount to, at this point in the game, at 4 weeks, to really pull apart a surgical repair. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean you should be going out and doing cartwheels.
Mm-hmm. It's typically going to be a fast movement.
Correct.
that gets you in trouble. So if you're reaching slowly for something and you feel some pulling, some stretching, you're okay. If you were to fall on an outstretched arm, that would not be good. So it's the quick, sudden movement that's going to cause you the most trouble.
With load.
With load,
So with load, like if you're like,
quickly picking up that one-year-old and swinging it back and forth.
Right. Or reaching to catch the one-year-old if they're losing their balance.
Exactly. So those are the kind of things you need to be cognizant of.
Like Dan, when he slipped and ruptured his hamstring, that quick, loaded, sudden movement, that's what's going to get you.
Right.
Does that help, Jane?
Yes, thank you very, very much.
Appreciate the call. Bradley in Whitewater, your turn. Hi, Bradley.
Yes, hi there. So I'm in the market for a new pair of shoes. I don't run. I just, you know, do life and need a pair of walking shoes. And I was really amazed when I went in. Things have changed a lot in the last, like, year since I bought a pair of shoes. And the ones that I'm seeing now, some of them have an amazing amount of foam that they've added to the sole, or the whole thing is what they call fresh foam or memory foam. Sometimes it seems like as much as 2 inches. And I tried some a pair on, walking around, and yes, it feels very cushy, but I'm just thinking, long term, is this a good thing, or is it going to cause problems?
Oh, that's a lovely question. And, you know, in medicine and in so many things in life, we have these big swings back and forth. So remember, it seems like it wasn't that long ago, we had the barefoot, the minimalist shoes.
Yeah.
People running barefoot, people running in minimalist shoes with no support. And now we've swung the other direction with these giant things on people's feet. Being a middle child myself.
You always got the hand-me-downs?
I got the hand-me-downs, but I'm also like, I swing to the middle. Like, I stay in the middle. Like, to me, 2 inches of foam in the bottom, too much.
Yeah.
You're at a danger of falling off your foam, but we'll set that aside. But I think it's too shock-absorptive for the average person. Now, that being said, if you spend your day walking on concrete... Mm-hmm. If you're working on a factory floor, if you're working somewhere where you are walking for hours on concrete, then having something that's shock absorptive is useful. Not all foam is necessarily shock absorptive. It's just foamy. It doesn't necessarily offload the joints any. So you really need to look for materials that have been shown through engineering kinds of studies to absorb shock.
And our running biomechanist, we have a physical therapist, running biomechanist, and he gets asked this question all the time. And apparently within the running world, and I'm guessing we could apply it to the walking world as well, you shouldn't have to break in a pair of shoes when you leave the store. They should be comfortable. And the higher the price doesn't mean the shoe is better. So you get to kind of a mid-range price, and anything above that, unless, like Lori alluded to, you need it for something very specific, it's not a very good return on your investment. So a $200 shoe is not twice as good as a $100 shoe. So I think Lori's statement is very accurate in that kind of sit middle of the road. And the other option you can always do if you need a little bit more cushion, as long as you have room for it, and you can always buy an off-the-shelf orthotic and take out whatever the orthotic is in the shoe and add a little bit more cushion that way.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. Especially if you need a little bit of arch support or something like that.
And I'm glad you mentioned the walking on concrete versus walking on the... Because I was thinking about my own case where a few years back with daughter Emily and her cross country, most of my walking is on pavement, but then the pair of shoes I had running,
cross country course,
running the cross country course is sort of unstable. It's not, I got a different pair of shoes.
That makes perfect sense.
It was unsteady.
Right. Well, and you think about a lot of factory workers who are on concrete all day, typically they have to wear steel-toed work boots.
Yeah.
And so for many of those people, you accommodate things by putting an insole on the inside because you can't do things to the soles on the outside. So you have to think, you have to kind of be creative.
There you go, Bradley. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our physical therapist, with us today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we'll hear from Lake Mills veterinarian Bill Stork. He's going to be talking about sharing do's and don'ts regarding traveling with your pets. And then we'll talk about reptiles as pets with Bill Stewart from WPS Reptiles in Kenosha. Right now, we are taking a look at physical therapy issues, and Gary in Milwaukee has a question for our guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Gary, what's on your mind?
Hello. Well, it's not really a question, but an earlier caller called in with a dilemma as to whether or not to get a partial replacement on her knee or a full. And I thought I would weigh in on that conversation with my own experience. Back in 2005, I got a partial. I got a couple of opinions on it, and one doctor said, don't do it. You're going to need a full eventually anyway. But another doctor said, yeah, let's do it, and so I did it. 4 years later, I was back in for a full in 2009, and actually I was in quite a bit of pain by then again. And it was a messier surgery than it would have needed to be with the scar tissue that was in place from the earlier surgery. The big difference is that I was in my late 40s when I had this first surgery done. I believe the caller from Stone Lake was in her mid-60s.
58.
And so, yeah, so the best I can, I mean, from my own personal experience, I may have to have a replacement on my right knee eventually. I will not get a partial. I will get a full. Actually,
okay. Yeah, thanks for calling, Gary. Comment on that, Jill?
So I 100% understand what you're saying, Gary, and I would say that the advancements in the surgery for a unicompartmental knee replacement have changed dramatically in 20 years. So that was 20 years ago, and now we have this robot-assisted, and I would say the advancements in the technology have improved considerably. And that may, because they're less invasive, cut down on the scar tissue that Gary was talking about. He had so much scar tissue afterwards.
And at this point, you know, I'm not sure what your age is, but the total joint replacement may be the best surgery for you at this point in time. And in your 40s, you know, you really don't want to go with the total joint if you don't have to, especially in 2005. Because it's not gonna last your lifetime. And to take down a total knee is unpleasant.
Right.
Is what I've been told. So
and this is Gary brings up an excellent point though. As our society is aging, total joints are one of the biggest elective musculoskeletal surgeries performed. I don't know if it's in the world, but
the biggest. I think it is the biggest
in the United States. So, as a consequence, I would say they're constantly trying to develop better procedures, better materials, better stabilization, because this is getting to be, unfortunately, so commonplace in our society.
And when you say elective surgery, do you mean surgery that is not covered by insurance?
No. Surgery that you choose to do as compared to surgery you have to do, for example.
From a car accident.
Yeah.
Okay. Or falling down a flight of stairs and I dislocated my shoulder, now I need it. So with an elective surgery, it's time. We talked about bad days outweighing good days. Let's find a good time that I can have the surgery performed. Okay. My daughter can come and help me, things like that.
And, in the category of progress, we just got notice at UW that the standard hip precautions, flexion past 90, internal rotation, across the body, they're out
gone.
The window.
They're gone.
And so in my entire career, which has now spanned close to 40 years.
Decades.
Many decades. Right. These hip precautions have been in place and they are going away.
Absolutely.
So again, progress.
Right.
Not only in the surgical technique, but now because surgery, you know, for whatever reason, the hip precautions are going away.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things we grill in our PT students, which will no longer be a test question.
Right. No longer be a test question, exactly.
But Gary brings up, this is a really good point for us to have this conversation. So
thank you for sharing. I'm really glad that he called.
Yeah.
So we could talk about this. That's
absolutely
awesome.
Thanks,
and good
Gary.
Luck with your next one, Gary.
Yeah.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you for calling. Alice in Maple, your turn. Hi, Alice.
So, hi, thank you. About a week ago, a little less, I was on a trail run and I tripped on a root and fell on my I put my arm out and fell on it and dislocated it.
Your shoulder?
My shoulder. And I had to walk about a mile back a little bit more, just like hanging my arm, because I could feel it was like in my armpit.
Mm-hmm.
And after about half an hour, it went back into place.
Excellent.
And I did go to urgent care for ortho 3 days later, and they said that, yeah, it was in good place again. But I have a little fracture of the glenoid posterior.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, and I can't get into physical therapy for like 3 or 4 weeks. So I'm using it, like, because I'm active. I have horses and I'm doing firewood and things, but I try to use my left arm mainly. But I am using my right arm as tolerated. I'm wondering if I can injure it.
Oh, that's a great question. So my guess is that fracture that they're seeing is a Hill Sachs lesion.
Yes.
Right, would be my guess if it's on the...
But it's usually on the humeral head.
That's right, the humeral head. Yeah.
So she could have just chipped off a little bit of her
right.
glenoid, and it's
right.
probably a stable, probably
right.
had an intra-articular fracture.
Right.
Alice, can I ask how old you are?
71.
All right.
Not a girl.
Yep, exactly. You go, girl.
Yeah.
So can you injure it? Not likely.
Right. So,
yeah.
And part of the reason I asked her age is because typically... with younger people, we see a bigger risk of redislocations, things like that. And in Alice's demographic, she's probably a little bit more stable. So I wouldn't worry as much about her feeling unstable. And I agree with you, Alice. I think doing gentle, easy range of motion, making sure that you can move it so you don't get a frozen shoulder, which you are in the demographic for, would be really good.
Yeah, somehow I don't see it with her lifestyle.
100%.
Cutting
wood and trail running.
Right,
yeah.
Right. The most likely thing to happen in an older person, not elderly, you are not elderly, in an older person, if is a rotator cuff tear.
Yeah.
So if you dislocate, you're less likely to re-dislocate, but more likely to have torn your rotator cuff. So just use it, whatever feels comfortable, and CPT when you get in. And you may wave at them, and they may say, awesome,
you look great.
Let's check your rotator cuff strength.
Yeah.
And thanks, Alice. And speaking of rotator cuffs, Dan in Madison has a quick question, I believe, relating to it. Dan,
about a year ago, September of last year, I was in a motorcycle accident. And I was in ICU for a couple days. Anyway, after I got out, I noticed my shoulder was really sore. I talked to my doctor. They said, I think I tore my rotator cuff. They said, no, you didn't. Anyway, long story short, I got an MRI. I have had a partial tear of my rotator cuff. The physical therapist at the time said, well, you know, you really don't need surgery. We can do surgery, but it's probably going to be a longer recovery. That I could do a cortisone injection, but that actually makes it weaker. So they gave me physical therapy. I did the physical therapy. I wasn't religious about it like I should have been, but my shoulder actually started feeling better. Then about a month ago, I was riding motorcycles again, and just I didn't crash or anything, but I had to lift my bike up this off-road riding, and I seemed to have re-injured that rotator cuff. It feels about the same as it did before. And I'm just wondering if I should just start doing the physical therapy that I was doing before again.
Yes.
For sure. And to be honest, Dan, I would, it sounds to me like you kind of self-graduated from PT or decided kind of when you were done. If you're going to be having to lift a motorcycle, I would not only do really good rotator cuff strengthening, but get a really good strengthening program in general as a preventative so you don't constantly kind of keep re-aggravating this rotator cuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're going to be doing, I would make cuff exercises kind of like dental flossing. I think you need to do it on a regular basis, and then I'd add some other strengthening too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep. Dan, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today as we talk physical therapy issues. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Physical therapy on our minds. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody back with us today. What questions do you have? You can give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Martha in Kenosha. Martha, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I have an adverse reaction to an osteoporosis drug, Fosamax. I'm wondering if the physical therapists have any information or experience with that. I took 9 doses once a week. I've talked to my rheumatologist, and he agrees that the pain in my knees, the swelling in my knees, and the heaviness in my legs is a response to that. I'm wondering, it keeps me awake at night, and I'm wondering if they have any advice about what to do.
So let's just roll the tape back a second. You said your rheumatologist told you that?
Yeah.
Are you
Yeah.
also being treated for a rheumatologic condition?
No, I went to him because I was reluctant to start on Fosamax anyhow, and my bone density showed that I needed that kind of medication.
So you didn't go back to your osteoporosis doctor and discuss an alternative medication to the Fosamax?
Yes.
Have you done that?
No, I haven't started on anything else.
Okay, but you are going to change something up for your osteoporosis?
I'm just reluctant because they're all long lasting. You know, they last a year. One dose lasts a year. And if I have more problems,
I see.
Then I'll have these side effects for a long time till it wears off.
So the short acting gave you had a negative side effect. So you're concerned about the longer ones. Okay. Martha, are you on some sort of program from an exercise perspective to increase your bone mineral density in addition to taking this medication?
Yes, I tried to get 2 miles of walking in. I have a treadmill. My husband's in a wheelchair, so we do a lot of doctor's appointments with, you know, pulling that in and out of the back of the car. I have a lot of flowers to take care of, and so I'm really pretty active.
Okay, so I think it would be useful, particularly if you're not going to be taking any medication for your osteoporosis, to talk with a nutritionist to make mm-hmm. sure you're getting sufficient nutrition to support your bone health. I also think you should see a physical therapist to get set up on a program to strengthen your bones. So walking is only one activity. It will strengthen your bones in a specific way. It will not strengthen them in other ways. So we talk about having odd forces, that is moving in different directions, dancing being sort of a classic example, where you move in a variety of different ways so that you load your bones differently. So doing the same activities, even if you are active, is not sufficient to maintain your bone health. So seeing a physical therapist to getting set up on a good structured program, or potentially even joining a class mm-hmm. that does exercises specifically designed to address your osteoporosis, as well as meeting with a registered dietitian to discuss nutrition to support your bone health.
And the other thing is, just like anything else, your body starts accommodating something. So if you do the same walking distance every day and the same pace, eventually your body's going to say, well, I don't need to lay down any more bone because you're not testing me in different ways. And so you need what we call muscle confusion or bone confusion. It has to be used in so many different ways, variety. Like Lori said, so walking the same amount, eventually you will have diminished returns on your investment on your bone mineral density.
Things to think about, Martha.
Yeah,
thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Jay in Loganville, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I'm 66 years old, and I've developed neuropathy in my feet and my left foot. It's worse than the right, but in the summer it's not as huge an issue, but in the winter I even have to go so far as I soak my feet in warm water, or even wear heated socks. And I just wonder if there's some other relief for neuropathy. I do notice that in my muscles in my calf, they're just like pulsating. It's like there's an alien inside my calf. And I wondered if that's also some significance to this neuropathy.
And the neuropathy is?
Idiopathic. In most cases, it's idiopathic. We don't know what causes it. It is
pain.
It's generally pain. Sometimes people get burning. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people get tingling and numbness. Sometimes people feel like they're walking on pebbles. Sometimes people can't feel their feet at all. It presents in a number of different ways, all of them neurologically based. So numbness, tingling, burning, pain, pressure, you name it. Unfortunately, there is no treatment for it. So we help people manage their symptoms. So Jay mentioned that he soaks them in warm water. I see a number of people who come to the warm water pool to exercise because many times people are unable to exercise on land because of the symptoms in their calves and in their feet. It's just too painful for them. So they can exercise in the pool, and that warm water and the hydrostatic pressure on their feet helps with their pain. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the best mm-hmm. that we can do.
Yeah, there you go, Jay. Thank you for calling. Margaret in Fox Cities, your turn. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. So I had a hip replacement on the left side on October 1st, and at the same time, the surgeon did what he called a significant repair of a tendon. And so when I saw him last Tuesday, he was saying everything's going well with the hip repair, but that I still can only do 50% weight bearing on the left leg because of the tendon repair. I see him again on November 12th, and I'm just wondering, after November 12th, which would be 6 weeks out, what can I expect in terms of being able to not need my walker and so on?
Well, you're only 50% weight bearing right now, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay, so we're going to keep you at 50% weight bearing until you see him in November. He'll probably allow you to go full weight bearing, but with an assistive device for a little bit. And so you'll still probably be on your walker for, my guess is, a few weeks, then maybe progress to a cane of some sort. The biggest thing will be making sure that you have adequate strength and balance. And because, unfortunately, right now, Margaret, you're unable to do fully weight-bearing activities on that leg because of the tendon repair, it's just going to slow everything down a little bit because you haven't had that foot on the ground. You don't have that input from your foot. Your balance will be off.
Well, if she's 50% weight-bearing, she should be putting her foot down and putting
some
weight on it.
Some,
yeah.
But
so what's,
not single-leg stuff.
Not single-leg stuff, yep, you're right. I think what's important now is to try to walk as normally mm-hmm. as possible, even though you're only putting half your weight on that leg. So heel down, roll onto the ball of your foot, bend your knee, straighten your knee out as you take that step. Try to make your gait symmetrical left to right without putting all of your weight on it. Are you able to do that at this point? Does it feel comfortable walking?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
I mainly say to myself when I'm stepping on my left foot, push down on the walker with my arms.
Great.
To
okay.
Put that.
And is there a plan to send you to physical therapy?
I am already in physical therapy, but they say, you know, we pretty much, I'm still going once a week, but they say until he clears me to use both legs, they kind of exhausted the range of different things they can do.
The other option would be a pool. Right. They mm-hmm. are correct, Margaret. The other option would be if there's a pool where you mm-hmm. could do some walking or some activities there, because that you could do that and respect your weight-bearing restrictions.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Although she may be too close to surgery yet in terms of her incision
100%.
To get in the pool.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There
yeah.
you go.
So she is kind of in that little bit of that holding pattern. Yep.
Yep.
Margaret, good luck. Thank you for calling. Willow in Madison, your turn. Hi, Willow.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Early last year, I went to Orlando, and I spent about 6 weeks there, and I would do walking every morning. After about a week or so, I felt my lower legs below my knees there, this jiggling sensation. I didn't pay attention to it until about a week later, after a shower, I looked down, and they were all swollen. Both were swollen, along with the top of my feet and my toes, and also my forearms, all swollen. My daughter took me to a hospital there, Advent Health, and they did a series of tests, urinalysis, blood tests, checked my heart, and all they could tell me was, take it easy with the walking and keep your feet elevated, which I did. After a while, it didn't help, so I came back to Madison, and I went to my doctor here at UW, and they did the same test plus some more, and they couldn't give me a definitive answer. And the swelling eventually went away. Along with that, I don't know if they're related, but I have enlarged prostate, and I'm due for surgery later on this month. Mm. Is there an answer to what caused the swelling?
Well, let's see. You've been to two medical institutions who have run a battery of tests, and they haven't come up with anything.
I'm just trying to think. Yeah. Gravity dependent. Is there some sort of right. fluid? The reason it would end up in all extremities mm-hmm. in that dependent distal. Position.
Yeah. So it makes you think that there's not a good venous return.
Right.
But I would expect that somebody would have checked that, because it seems like that would be the obvious
correct.
Answer, like
the
a
lowest hanging
cardiac,
fruit. The lowest
a cardiac
hanging fruit.
Issue. Yeah. And so I'm guessing they checked his heart and so on. So.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Willow, did you try any compression socks or compression garments? And if so, did that make a difference?
I did, both in my lower legs and my arms.
And?
And it appeared it helped.
Yeah. Mm. So, I mean, I wonder vascular. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking vascular, is there a problem with the valves?
Mm-hmm.
Or lymph?
Lymphedema. Lymphedema. Some sort, like lymphatic mm-hmm. drainage issues.
Lymphatic drainage
issues.
Well,
that's interesting. Yeah.
So I don't know. It could be something with your lymph system, because that's something that we see. And I don't know what the underlying cause of that would be in your case.
Either.
But we do have a physical therapist at the spine clinic at Research Park that specializes in lymph. There's also an OT, I believe, who does lymph work. So that'd be another avenue to look at.
Mm-hmm.
But first you have a surgery coming up. So, you know, start with that and then see. So have you had the swelling again? It happened that one time. Has it happened again?
Yes, but not as severe. Just slight swellings, and they go away by themselves.
Huh. Mm-hmm. All right. I don't know. So it might be interesting to get a referral to see the physical therapist
right.
who specializes in lymph and see if they have anything to add to this.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Good luck, Willow. Thank you for calling. Brad emailed to say he had an RT laparoscopic inguinal hernia surgery in mid-May. The hernia is corrected, but they are still experiencing pain around the groin area of the surgery. Are there exercises that Brad can do to help with the pain?
So if Brad has not seen a physical therapist, I would
be.
Definitely, just because of all of the fascial layers, I'm guessing it was probably done arthroscopically, mm-hmm. but all of the fascia that they have to go through to do an inguinal repair, that can get so tight.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing a physical therapist to increase the mobility between all those fascial layers would be the first place I would start.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then I'd add in a strengthening program. But I'm guessing
yeah.
mobility is probably
right.
the number
that
one
would
problem.
That would be my guess as well.
Yeah.
Suzanne in Little Chute, hearing back from you, I believe.
Hi. I had called in a couple of months ago about I have Pellegrini Stida syndrome,
mm-hmm.
and I had told you at that time I had a total of 3 cortisone shots, and then I did go to about 6 weeks of physical therapy, and some of what they did help, like patellar molds and some adductor stretching, but ultimately it just made the pain worse. as I tried, and we tried together to strengthen everything, like squats and abduction, just made it worse. So I went back and had another MRI, or had an MRI previously to just send x-rays. So I'm scheduled to have surgery in about 10 days or so, and what he plans to do is remove the calcification in the medial collateral ligament, and I also have some severe arthritis in the patellar region, and he's going to try to scrape that up.
Clean it up, yeah. Mm-hmm. So okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you tried the conservative route as best you could, and with the Pellegrina Staita, that's that calcific mass in your MCL. So basically it's kind of like a bony block where there mm-hmm. shouldn't be one, which would affect your gait mechanics, mm-hmm. things like that. So they're going to remove that, and then they're going to do what I call a shave and a haircut and mm-hmm. clean up any loose bodies or anything under your patellofemoral joint.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll need really good rehab yeah. after that. The exercises will probably be somewhat similar to what you're doing now, but should feel a heck of a lot better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you just, I think one of the big cautions would be the patellofemoral joint. So that
correct.
Clean up under there could cause some pain in the front of your knee and some quadriceps avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
So getting on a really good rehab program for your quadriceps will be really important after the surgery.
And using a plunger. So Lori talked about a plunger earlier, and we never really followed up with what that is.
Yeah.
But a company makes them. They're very small. They look like plungers that you would use for your kitchen sink.
Mm-hmm.
And you put an ultrasound gel or some sort of medium.
Vaseline
works great around the rim. And then literally you put it over your kneecap and then you pull up. So as physical therapists, we like to mobilize the kneecap, and we can do up and down. We can do superior and inferior and side to side. But so many people with mm-hmm. patellofemoral pain, I just want somebody to lift my kneecap up and unload it. And that's what the plunger does. So when you go see your PT, ask them if they can plunge your knee.
There we go. Thank you for calling. Ron in La Crosse. Hi.
Yes. I just wonder if the physical therapists that are your guests ever heard of something called the Earth Sole. It's basically a pair of shoes. I bought a pair in the 70s where the thickest part of the sole is in the front mm-hmm. and not under the heel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I do have scoliosis, it's been so long since I found a new pair, but I just wonder, would having a reverse sole, you know, the thicker part in the front of the shoe be beneficial for anybody with back problems?
Oh, that is such an individual question.
Right.
And I just had like a flashback because I had those
shoes. I did too. I bought them on State Street when I moved
nice.
Here in the 90s.
Oh my
gosh. So they were
still around. Yes, yes, yes. So as we said earlier, when Bradley called about shoes, like things swing, you know, let's do the Earth shoes where the heel is lower. You get a nice stretch of your Achilles tendon. So I tell you, if you go from that thick 2-inch sole to an Earth shoe, you're going right. to be back in with Achilles tendinopathy. So a decision about shoes is very individual, like a straight last, a curve last, mm-hmm. a stiff sole, a flexible sole. I cannot make a generalization
right.
other than to say you need the shoe that fits your case.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be why you see a physical therapist or mm-hmm. someone who specializes in orthotics or shoes or so on, who can advise you. So
mm-hmm.
if you have scoliosis, there's a chance you're asymmetrical in the frontal plane and you may have one leg that appears longer than the other. So you might need a lift in one shoe and not the other shoe, as an example. So great question.
Right.
I love the shoe questions, but I can't make a global statement that there is one kind of shoe that's better for everybody.
Right.
Great question, Ron.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ron. Tom emailed to ask what precautions are no longer necessary for hip replacements that we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier, and where can Tom find out about the procedure?
So with a posterolateral approach, which is the most common approach, you were to avoid hip flexion to 90 degrees.
Past 90 degrees.
Adducting or kind of squeezing your legs together.
Or crossing your legs over the other.
Crossing your legs over the other, and then internal rotation. So the big thing would be to be like across your surgical leg, up and over your non-surgical leg. That would that combination mm-hmm. of flexion mm-hmm. and adduction mm-hmm. yeah. Was the problem child for many people. And it put you at risk of dislocation was my understanding. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps the components have improved such that that risk is
you know, as I said to my patients when, you know, sometimes they'd be 6 months out and they're, I can't flex past 90. And I'd say, you know, A, you're 6 months out. And B, I always felt like it was the combination
yes.
of flexion, internal rotation, and adduction that got you in trouble, not any one of those components in isolation. Where can you find more information? You can look at UW Health site and look at hip replacement. You can go to the AAOS, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. You can probably go to the Mayo Clinic website. Any WebMD. Of those, WebMD, all those will have information on total hip replacements.
Mm-hmm.
Jane emailed to ask, what are potential risks for a person having a spinal fusion and scoliosis to undergo hip replacement? So she has spinal fusion mm-hmm. and scoliosis. What about a hip replacement?
So if she's already got her spine fused at multiple levels and now she's having a hip replacement, it she'll just have to be very cognizant about where she gets her mobility from because, you know, if you're having your hip replaced, all of us can bend really well and wiggle through our spine. Jane can't do that because her spine is fused. And so she would just need to be very cognizant of the fact that she's going to have to be careful how she moves the first few weeks.
Right. But she may feel better because her hip may move better than it did
Absolutely.
Before her surgery. So once she recovers from the acute surgical event, she may find that she's doing better. I would highly recommend Jane get in a pool for her rehab mm-hmm. because of the asymmetries that happen with scoliosis and so on, and because of the position sometimes they're put in during surgery,
right.
It can flare up somebody's back. So recovering in a pool where you can decompress the spine at the same time mm-hmm. is often a good advice.
Right.
And finally, Cody just wanted to share that one thing he wished he'd known prior to getting a knee replacement in their mid-40s. The body, being younger, the body wants to heal, and that can create scar tissue quickly.
Yeah, right.
The med femur tourniquet during the surgery can cause hamstring and quadricep problems or damage.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. yep.
And don't hesitate to complement physical therapy with massage and or acupuncture.
Absolutely.
All good points mm-hmm. to
great
end
tips.
On.
All great tips. You
Very
bet.
Very good.
You bet.
And thank you both. You'll be back in a month and we'll do this again.
Sounds great.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks to those great callers.
Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW Madison. They'll be back in a month and we'll do this all over again. And coming up, we'll talk with a doctor who just underwent knee replacement surgery and find out what it's like to be on the other end of things. I'm Larry Mueller.